May 31st, 2018, artnet.com. Here's the headline. This rare Chinese vase sat in storage at an Oklahoma museum for years. Now, the $14.5 million it won at auction changes everything. There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Museums acquire, they keep, they care for their objects, and it always causes a bit of a stir when a museum decides to sell something from its collection. About a year and a half ago, at Christie's in Hong Kong, an 18th century Chinese vase, in a single lot auction, sold for $14.5 million. Since 1960, and right up until the sound of that gavel, the vase was part of the permanent collection at Philbrook Museum of Art. We recently invited Philbrook director Scott Stoolen to tell us the story behind this sale and this decision. So let's dispel some myths, if we can. When this vase sold, media started taking notice, and one of the things that took hold of the narrative was this idea that Philbrook had this vase in our basement, and it was just sitting there. People are imagining this dusty space where all these treasures are stored, and we just pulled it off the shelf and said, hey, maybe this is worth something. But one, we don't really have a basement where we keep art. We actually have art storage. But when did this item first come across your radar? You've been at the museum now for 3 years. Was this something that just came out of left field?
No, it was something, it was known to be in the collection of something of significance. Quite the level of significance wasn't completely known, but this came out of a process of actually assessing the entire collection. So when I came in, part of the process is we wanted to go through and actually examine different areas of the collection, look for weaknesses, look for strengths, look for some things that we may not have out on display that we may want to have out on display, and kind of get an overall kind of read of what's there. So this came out of that process. So this was not the only object that was looked at. This is one of 600 Asian objects that we had Christie's come in and review.
So in the museum industry, the concept of deaccessioning is pretty controversial still, but just for people who may not know, what does it mean to deaccession a piece from a collection?
Sure.
Or,
I mean,
for that matter, what it means to accession a piece?
Yeah, I mean, these are the fancy museum worlds for basically like buy and sell. So accessioning a work is a museum basically saying we're going to acquire this work, and the difference is it's saying we're actually acquiring this into the permanent collection. And by doing that, it comes with a bunch of agreements with it, and that is to care and protect that piece basically in perpetuity. So that's a big obligation that comes
with it. It's almost like
that.
An adoption or something.
Yeah, it is. And it's, you know, the big part of it is that as you build that collection, there's costs that come with that, and there's a lot of things of different types of care. So there's a difference between a work on paper or a ceramic vase, for example, as far as what it needs for care going forward. So to accession is to bring into the collection. To deaccession is basically to undo that. And that's kind of the big, you know, the D word in the museum field. And it's not done very often at all. And you're seeing more of it. And that conversation is actually changing a bit now. And part of it is that it's a complicated process. And there's a lot of different aspects of that. A big one is donor intent. Another one is making sure that you're doing it by the guidelines set forth by the museum industry and doing that properly. It's to make sure that things aren't done improperly, which can cause a whole realm of like ethical concerns that can come up from it.
So, for example, when you talk about some of the rules and regulations or just the standard norms around this, the Association of Museum Directors has some guidelines in place for if you do this, and you retain some funds from the sale of these objects, you can only do X, Y, or Z. And that's part of the whole agreement that we entered into. So what right. are some of those parameters?
Yeah, there's several different layers. And without getting like really too deep in this, to keep it kind of simple, the first one is donor intent. That's the first, the kind of the high level one. This was gifted to the museum with what type of restrictions? In our case with the vase, there was no restrictions on it. It was gifted for the betterment of Philbrook going forward in whatever manner that may take shape. Sometimes the donor is very specific. This can never be sold. Sometimes it can only be sold and replaced with work of the same type. So like Asian work for Asian work, contemporary for contemporary. And there can be a whole lot of different kind of stipulations placed on it. Most museums want to take things in where they have the least amount of restrictions, but that isn't always the case. So that's first, is kind of understanding that. Second is making sure that you're following the AAMD guidelines and AAM guidelines about deaccessioning. So that can be things like, the biggest one is this, accessions need to stay in the accession side of the world. So art for art, building for building. So you basically can't sell art to repair your roof. That's
right.
One of the big things there, is not having things that kind of easily slip over into that side. And the fear, of course, is that you get, you know, some rogue director in or some board that's in that wants to build a new wing by selling some artwork there. And the fear is always with that is that it restricts people wanting to give artwork. If you're giving a work of art and you think that 10 years from now they're going to trade it in for shingles, that may restrict people wanting to give those things.
So with all those concerns in mind, what kind of landmines did you see when this idea came about? Obviously, a lot of due diligence took place. What were some of the first steps?
So the first step of this is actually us reviewing our internal processes. So we reviewed our collection policy. We went and looked at through all of that and making sure that was all up to date. And we actually revised several sections of that. We brought in the outside experts, in this case, Christie's, to get a evaluation on it and be able to get some advice, whether this was the right time to move forward or something like that. And then we looked into the records with the family and contacted, in this case, it's just third cousins, and looking through. But we did contact and say that this is something we're planning on doing and giving notification. So we kind of went through all of those processes. And then it goes through an internal process, too, with the board. So our collections committee, which is the first step, has to approve it and say we'd like to deaccession this work. And then that actually goes to the executive committee of the board for final approval before we can move forward. So there's several different layers as part of that approval process.
When the piece was first assessed a few years ago, the value was much less. And obviously the market had to be just right. So as the years progressed and the valuation kept going up and up, how do you know when is the right time? Because I guess the question becomes, what if it keeps going up? Are you selling at a low point, at a high point? Do you just have to kind of trust the people at Christie's and say, this is probably the high watermark for when this could go?
It's an educated guess like anything. And you're trying to kind of catch the market at the right moment, also catch the right time for the museum. And sometimes there isn't a perfect time. You're kind of making a decision with the best available information. So in this case, the valuation had continued to climb, and actually exponentially, and this is really kind of unheard of, going from an appraised value of about $150,000 in the 80s up to $9 to $12 million in over the course of just a couple of decades. So the Asian market completely changed. But it's taking the advice of the experts that we have at the auction house, looking at the market, how it had climbed, and seeing what the expectation for the next couple of years were. And we kind of were in agreement, both for the institution and for this particular work, that it was getting close to a peak value, that there wasn't going to be another huge jump from this that we could see going forward. But we also could see a decline coming possibly too. So we thought the timing was actually right to move on this. But of course, you never know.
Yeah.
And you're making an educated guess.
Well, let's talk about that night. So it's May 30th of 2018. All of the wheels were in motion. The piece had been sent over to Hong Kong with Christie's. They did a lot of things for this. There were videos produced. They produced, I'm holding this beautiful book. Now, people probably need to realize this was a single lot auction. This vase was the only part of this part of the auction. It was lot number 8888. And the estimates were that the piece was going to go from 8 or 9 million to maybe upwards of 11 or 12 million. Obviously, with the time change, it was late in the evening here when we were watching it there. And so we were all, I know we were all watching via, streaming online.
Right.
And when it started to hit those numbers that were expected, you see that 8, 9 million, 10 million, and then it just keeps climbing. And then we eventually end at $14.5 million, which when you look at Hong Kong currency is even more crazy.
Yes.
When you start seeing those numbers. So it took me a minute to kind of think about it and realize what the actual number was. And that's a big number. And it's kind of impressive to people. And when you talk about things in the millions, people get really excited about it. But I guess at the end of the day, when you saw a number like that, what does that mean in terms of what Philbrook can do with it now? Because the acquisition budget had been fairly anemic for years.
Yeah, the acquisition budget, because we take kind of earnings that kind of roll off of that, was around $75,000 or so a year, which for a museum of Philbrook size is not large. And so if you're going to get any more significant work, you need to pool multiple years in order to do that. And so
because you're talking about works on paper, you're not going to be acquiring any major paintings or anything like
that. No, and when you do that, I mean, like, for example, when we purchased our Kennedy Wiley that we got recently, that was multiple years of pooling to be able to do that. So you're limited, and you can't kind of go on the market every year or even take advantage of certain opportunities that come along. So in this case, it was a unique opportunity to change that scenario going forward. And, you know, we saw the estimates for it, but you really don't know. And, you know, Christie's rolled out all sorts. It was the side of a bus in Hong Kong that had all sorts of different merchandise, a full page ad with this. But knowing that your market for this is a couple of people that are truly in the market for this type of work and can spend that type of money. So you're hoping to get the attention of a couple of people that'll bid against each other. And so the night of the auction, yes, we're all watching it live stream. I was doing it from my kitchen table at like 6:30 at night as it's kind of going down. One of our board members happened to be in the room, so he's texting me on one end. I'm getting a couple other board members that happen to be in
Paris. Hong Kong.
From Hong Kong. So I'm getting Paris and Hong Kong, different directions, different times a day coming in. And I have my currency calculator in front of me, too, to actually see where it is. And I can say from a director's standpoint, you're making this decision. The biggest thing is you want to hit reserve because you don't want to make the decision and then have it kind of like, you know, not do what you were hoping. We did have a reserve on it, of course, but you wanted to do better than that. So when it starts to climb and you start seeing it hit, okay, there's the low reserve.
So that your first wave of stress is now.
Correct.
Okay.
We're at least a little too long for my comfort. It probably was seconds. It felt like forever at the opening bid. And then it started to take off. And there was a person in the room that ended up actually being the buyer and an online bidder that were going back and forth on it. And it continued to climb. And then it starts to get to the high end of kind of the estimates. And you start to really take a sigh of relief. And it continues to go past that. And everything after that, I was thinking, is just bonus.
Yeah.
So in the end of the day, you know, it landed at, with the buyer's premium on top of it, was $16.7 million U.S. dollars, of which, you know, we got about 14.8 of that became this fund for acquiring artwork going forward. So what does that mean for the institution? It basically takes, just taking the earnings from that fund, takes up our ability for purchases up 10 times every year.
So basically that lump sum goes into an endowment, right?
It's some kind of investment fund. It's invested. It's not technically an endowment because the difference between an endowment, this endowments typically are set up to be there in perpetuity forever. This is set up in a fund. They're invested similar ways, but it's set up in a way to actually spend it over time. So we're not as protective of the corpus with the fund as we would be with the endowment. Now, we don't want to spend all that down immediately. We want to kind of spend the earnings off of it. But if an opportunity came, let's say this amazing collection for a couple million dollars came along, we could do that with this in ways that we wouldn't with the endowment.
So this caused quite a stir, not just locally, but, you know, there were articles written all over the place about this piece. But there was also some fun things happening locally. You got your own editorial cartoon in the local newspaper. And there was also an editorial, which was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
The editorial board at the Tulsa World wrote about this. And this kind of goes back to what you were talking about wanting to make sure we checked all the right boxes, did the due diligence needed to be done. And not to say that the Tulsa World editorial board is the end-all be-all of art acquisition ethics, but it was interesting to get that third-party affirmation. I'm going to kind of quote what they say. They said, "Sales of art museum collections are often controversial, but we can't see any problems with this. We reviewed a variety of ethics codes for art museums, which emphasize that proceeds from sales should always be used for acquiring more art or caring for current collections." That's exactly what you said. So, you know, having these third-party media outlets say, you know, you did it the right way, what did that mean to you?
It means everything. I mean, it's, you want to have your peers, and whether it's the local media, the board, or in this case, the amount of other museum directors and people in the field that came up privately after this and said that you did that exactly right. That means a lot. I mean, because you want to make sure you're following the letter of the law in this case and following all those rules, but also being brave enough to kind of take a move like this, that this really helps the museum in the long term. That one work of art will become hundreds over time. And it's something that for a museum of Philbrook's size is that absolutely is to the betterment and the health of the museum. So it's nice making that decision, but also having it reinforced that you went about the process in the appropriate way and had people kind of dig into that and didn't find any fault, which is honestly very encouraging and very reaffirming.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by your friend's annoying opinions about art. You really like hanging out with him, but anytime the subject of art or movies or music comes up, Mr. Know-It-All delivers an ill-advised soliloquy about the isms that go with this or that movement and the artist's intention and so forth. Please, please, just make it stop. Remember, just because you minored in Dada doesn't mean you have to be a major...
Let's talk about using some of this money. You're leaving tomorrow as we sit here to go to the Art Basel Art Fair in Miami Beach.
Right.
This is the American version of the art fair that happens in Switzerland every year. So this has been going on for quite a while.
Yeah.
And you go pretty much every year.
Yes.
We've acquired art before from not just there, but other things that are happening down there at the same time. We have this new acquisition fund in place. Are you going down there with any ideas of what you want to acquire? Do you go down with other collectors, people as, you know, how does this all work?
So we go down, we do have a collection plan. So there are things that we, as an institution, are kind of targeting over the coming decade, let's say. Areas of strength, areas that we want to kind of fill in some gaps that we may have in the collection. In our case, a lot of things that can kind of, you know, connect to other parts of the collection. And, you know, Art Basel is primarily contemporary work, so we're really looking at contemporary work, and that's actually stuff that's far more affordable for us, and looking at artists that we can kind of see that are on an upward trajectory in their career.
An investment of its own
Absolutely.
Kind.
We can buy at the right time. And now, Art Basel, I will say, is the worst place to go and buy anything for a deal, because everything's usually upcharged on there. But think about in a way of kind of like window shopping in some ways, but also if we see a right deal, and you can always negotiate for what's there. The one thing is this, is whatever you see on the wall is not what you're going to pay. That's a starting point for the negotiation.
Does it usually go up or down?
Down, always.
Okay.
And for museums, even more down, because for most artists and galleries, they'd rather have it placed in a museum than a private collection. It helps the valuation of the artist, and it helps the exposure of the artist as well. So we always work that, obviously, to our advantage as we're negotiating on a work. But yes, we have some targets of some artists that we want to check out that are down there, but it isn't like we have, like, this is exactly what we're going down to buy.
What do you love about Art Basel and things like that? Is it the networking, getting to meet other artists? What's something that you just enjoy the most every time you go do something like that?
I like meeting artists. As an artist myself, it's really fun meeting other artists and seeing some people too that you haven't seen in a while, because like the whole art world's down there for a period of a few days. So you get to meet a lot of people and see a lot of people and reconnect. And that's a lot of fun. It's also fun to see so much artwork in such a condensed area. Between the main fair and all the kind of outside fairs that are around it, there's just so much to see that you basically can see art for 4 days straight and not see it all. And that's fun. I think it's really fun to see that much. And also see what some of the trends are. You can kind of see what's happening in certain things that are kind of hot and certain things that people are trying to sell. So you get a temperature of what's happening in the field.
So you can kind of use it as a sounding board for kind of, are we relevant? Are we, you know, part of the current conversation happening right now, ahead of the game, behind the game?
You can, but I also would say, like, putting Art Basel to the side, I wouldn't use Art Basel as any sort of like barometer of what we're doing at the museum. I think that is a rarefied world that kind of exists. It's so much about the market. And there's parts of it that, of course, we're part of. But really looking at what the kind of driving force is behind that is a lot about economics. And what we're trying to do at the museum, you know, should be different than that. It doesn't mean that we're apart from that, because I think you have to kind of operate in some of those worlds. But I would say there's equal parts of going down an art fair about that I find actually kind of, you know, gross, to be honest. You kind of see how the sausage is made in the whole industry. You see how the economic side of things, which is very real. But it's also something that you see how oftentimes market forces are pushing certain things that have nothing to do with the artist or the art. It has everything to do with the economics behind it.
When you have a big chunk of money and you're looking at the museum in a long-term way, and you say, you know, we need to invest in the pieces that are going to have the longest and most lasting impact on the museum. If something is a bigger cost, but you think it's going to have that, versus kind of acquiring the smaller, maybe it might take hold, maybe it's an investment.
Yeah.
How do you start determining that? And who ultimately makes the call on something like that? We have curators, we have a board, like, you know, committees. You know, who's in the room for decisions like that?
Yeah, it's for the most part, it's the curators and myself kind of looking at things. And you do get some board input, but for the most part, they're taking that advice coming from our, you know, the experts that we have on staff. You are doing your due diligence of your research on the artists, on the particular piece, seeing what things have sold for in the past, trying to get the best possible deal. And I think the biggest thing, you know, really my philosophy looking at it too, is how is this work going to enhance our collection and impact the audience that we have coming in? There could be works out there that are better investments as far as like if you're looking at it monetarily. There could be things out there that might be better things on an academic side of things. But for us, the number one driving force is that how is our audience going to benefit from this? How are they going to learn from it, be inspired by it? How does it connect things? How is it going to bring people in? And how is it going to be something that's very accessible to them? So in all of that, you're trying to make the best possible decision with the resources you have to find the things that fit those holes. Are you going to miss every once in a while? Sure. You just want to make that relatively rare, and you don't want to miss on the, you know, the $5 million investments on that. And I think that's where kind of having some things that are maybe at a more, you know, mid to upper mid level of an artist, you have more opportunities to have multiple things that kind of hit on your audience.
One of the things that was talked about a lot when this whole thing went down was the concept of repatriation. Mm-hmm. And I know that was an important part of the conversation, which was this piece from China ended up back in China. And that's a conversation that happens a lot with deaccessioning. It also happens a lot with, you know, pieces that may have been gotten not from our museum specifically, but how was the piece acquired to begin with? You know, some of these somewhat blurry backstories about acquisitions or ill-gotten gains of different kinds. What does it matter that it ended up back in China? Is it that important to you?
It means a lot to me, actually. And it also means a lot that part of that process on the front of it, of doing our kind of due diligence and our research, the provenance on this work, so it's kind of documented history, was really airtight. So we knew that it came from a reputable source. We knew that it had been acquired in a proper manner. It had come to the U.S. in a completely proper manner. And we had all those records in place. So there was no question or some gray area.
Because this could get very sticky if there were gaps in information.
Very much so. And it would actually halt often some processes until you can figure that out. So in this case, we had all that documented very well, which made this a much easier process. And then really looking at putting it in the Hong Kong sale, which meant a higher likelihood it was going to go into an Asian collection. And it worked out that way. So it is going to go into an Asian collection. It's going to be with like works around it to be able to tell a more complete story, and it's going to be seen. And for me, it's going home in the best possible way. It's going to be going home as being part of, you know, the culture that it came from. But the biggest thing is that it's going to be able to tell a story within a museum with other objects in a way that we could never do at Philbrook.
Meaning it's not just sitting on a rich guy's mantle.
That's right. And like, you know, for me, that means a lot that it isn't just going to be or put in somebody else's vault. And, you know, for Philbrook, this is one of the decisions is that we knew that we could never acquire the works that would be needed to really wrap around this to tell the story that it deserved. And that was just
to provide context.
Absolutely. Yeah. And we just couldn't do it because partly the market had just exploded to a point where it wasn't financially possible and they weren't available. So this is a case of a kind of like it's a win-win. It's overused, but in this case, it really kind of is that.
You talk about timing and how important pulling the trigger on this decision at the right moment and working with those consultants to say, now is the time to do it. We got a good example of how quickly that could change because when the Trump administration put tariffs on China, some of the affected goods were art and antiquities. And if this had taken place at that time, this transaction would have been affected and we would have gotten less and
yes.
Say what you want about the politics of that, but that would have had a real world impact on this sale. So you kind of never know what's going to happen.
You don't. And we were concerned at the time because this was, you know, May of 2018. And looking at, the tariffs weren't something that we kind of saw coming on it. But yes, it would have actually had, you know, 7-figure impact on the institution. The other thing that we were closely watching is some of the tensions with North Korea that were happening at the same time is how was that going to impact the Asian collector market, because Christie's was a bit concerned about that as well. So we were watching kind of all of that, kind of fingers crossed that everything would remain status quo and everything went through without any issues there. But you never can really truly exhale until the payment comes fully in, which was another 6 to 8 months after actually the sale is completed too. So there's several of these processes along the way. And you also hope the person that bid on it is somebody that will come through with the sale. That's rare, but every once in a while something can fall through.
That's one of the reasons why we're talking about this now as opposed to the week after it happened, because there's so much back end to this, meaning did the money come through, all these different things. And we're really, it's over a year and a half or so later and really just now starting to use those funds, implement the funds. Early 2020, there's going to be a announcement of some acquisitions, pretty major artists. We're not going to say who or what yet, but those were acquired with some of this fund. So it's kind of fun time to start seeing what seemed a little bit in theory at the time become real now.
Absolutely. And we're excited because we're able to add, you know, significant pieces and well-known artists to our collection, and even some lesser-known artists, but the work of which I think will become very quickly favorites in the collection. And we're seeing some of the kind of the fruits of this whole process, which takes a while. I mean, it's 2 years basically later that we're actually able to kind of see what this becomes. But I'm really excited to see in the years to come here, it's going to completely change our collection. I mean, this is a game changer for a museum the size of Philbrook, because what it means now, and it means some things that probably you don't naturally think. Sure, it means we can go out and buy things that we couldn't before. But for me, even more importantly, is working with living artists now, is we can say, we're going to do an exhibition with you and we're going to acquire a work, or we're going to commission a piece for this particular exhibition that will become part of the permanent collection. That can be the difference between certain well-known artists working with you or not. And it just puts us on a whole different playing field in ways that we weren't before. And I think it's just going to have a lot of good impact going forward.
Dig it!
In January of 2006, at the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge, England, a 42-year-old man named Nick Flynn bumped into and broke several Chinese vases dating back to the Qing Dynasty. He was going up a staircase and tripped on his shoelace. Speaking to The Guardian shortly after, Mr. Flynn said, "I was trying to grab hold of something, but the walls were smooth marble and I couldn't stop myself. Although I knew the vase would break, I didn't imagine it would be loose and crash into the other two," he said. "I'm sure I only hit the first one, and that must have flown across the windowsill and hit the next one, which then hit the other, like a set of dominoes." Mr. Flynn was reportedly banned from the museum, at least for a short time. A spokeswoman for the Fitzwilliam Museum told The Guardian that the vases had been sitting on a windowsill for decades and had never met with an accident until Mr. Flynn's visit. She added, "Not everything is shut away in glass cases. An accident of this nature does, of course, bring the issue into sharper relief." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.